Well, we'll get started. We don't quite have a quorum yet, so we can't take any official action. But welcome to the committee, Chair Uli. And if you want to introduce your bill and proceed with your testimony, and when your witness is ready, she can say your name and for the tape, and we'll go with that. I need one more, so welcome.
Good morning, Chair Nelson and members. Thank you for having us. It's always interesting. I always thought we should start at 8:15 these meetings. I'm really good at like 8:03 is kind of my.
Well, we're at 8:04, so you should be good.
So I can feel for the members that are coming. Good morning. House File 1863 is a bit of a Band-Aid bill, if you will. We've had a few government shutdowns in previous years in Minnesota history. And, you know, actually Minnesota's had one of the longest shutdown in 2011 in the whole country, which is a bit of a embarrassment. But one of the things that this bill tries to address is that many of the folks that work for the state of Minnesota are impacted, as we saw with the recent shutdown of federal government. The employees are not paid. So what happens with this bill is that the employees will continue to be paid while we as politicians continue to work on our end of the business. So I think what the ultimate goal here is to treat our employees as you would essentially be treated yourself. So they would continue to be paid, and so you don't get into the debate of essential versus non-essential. Everyone's going to be paid, and they don't have the fear that goes with that and concern as we continue as politicians to go through and broker the deal. So this is not a continuing operation kind of thing. You know, it's not, you know, we have to come to a conclusion as politicians and come to an agreement ultimately still, but this would keep our employees harmless. So I just, I've asked one of our state employees to come, and she was impacted by the shutdown that happened in 2011. And I think it's important for all of us as members to kind of realize and put a human face on what this really means in reality. We have many new members, you know, coming into the legislature in the last couple of cycles, and they've been blessed not to go through a couple of things. You know, deficits has been and some of the difficult decisions we have to make with those, and having not probably lived personally like on the politician side of a shutdown. But with me this morning I have Ms. Christensen, and if it's okay with the chair and members, I'd like to hear from her.
And before she gives her testimony, we got a quorum now, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. I'll move House File 1863 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And welcome to the committee, and please again state your name for the tape. And
all right, good morning. My name is Kelly Christensen. I want to thank the chair and the committee today for the opportunity to testify. I've been a Minnesota Department of Transportation employee for 9 years. Prior to that, I worked for another state agency. So in total, I have 12 years of continuous state service. I come here today in support of House File 1863. In order to understand why I presently support this bill, it is important to take a walk in time with me and understand some important Minnesota events that are now part of our state's collective history. I was a MnDOT employee the summer of 2011. This particular summer was memorable to me, and unfortunately the memories are ones I do not want to ever repeat. I refer to the summer of 2011 as the year I and thousands of other state employees were used as pawns in a political tactic game. In other words, I was laid off for 3 weeks. I was at home not working, not collecting my regular paycheck for 20 days when our state legislative leaders and governor could not agree on how to balance the budget. In addition, my salary and many of my coworkers' salaries were used as a strategic tool to try to make a point. The unease of not knowing when I would get paid or be able to go back to work to do my job caused me considerable stress and anxiety because there was literally nothing I could do to change the outcome. I remember crying in a coworker's arms a few days before the shutdown, asking why we had to experience this. She just hugged me and said she didn't know. I remember watching the news every day during the shutdown and wondering, is this the day our elected leaders will finally come to an agreement? As one individual who has gone through this type of experience, I can tell you it is one of the most frustrating and maddening experiences to be used as a bargaining chip in a game of who can blink first. To use salaries for anything other than a means to pay employees who want to work should not be allowed to occur ever again in state government. To use completely innocent lives and something as important as their paychecks or livelihoods as a political strategy is immoral, uncalled for, and should be unthinkable. To inflict completely unnecessary pain throughout the state should be a completely archaic practice, never to be used again in state government. At the conclusion of the 20 days in July of 2011, this was the longest government shutdown in the country's history at the time. Is this the type of history we want for our great state of Minnesota? I certainly don't. The practice of withholding paychecks in this manner is completely unheard of in the private sector and any other sector other than government, and it's time we put an end to this. The summer of 2011 memories are never far from my mind of in May of odd number of years. The legislature usually comes down to the wire to completing their tasks, but I'm usually left wondering in early May, is this going to be another repeat of 2011? Let's fast forward to December of 2018 and January of 2019 and examine the national events of our country. Our country embarked on the longest federal government shutdown in its history. I couldn't help but compare the federal shutdown to the state shutdown Minnesota experienced in 2011. There were many congressional leaders on both sides of the political spectrum that were quoted as saying they were not in favor of shutting down the government as a political tactic and using people's livelihoods and salaries as a tactic to prove a point was immoral and ineffective at best. I was shocked when a bill passed that allowed federal employees to receive back pay when the shutdown was over. I was shocked because this was completely unheard of in 2011. I was completely supportive of this move, but wondered why myself as a state employee did not receive the same in 2011. Am I worth less than a federal employee? It feels pretty demoralizing and degrading when I see support of federal employees, but my current state doesn't currently have something like this in place. I want you to consider this. If every legislator and governor completes their assigned task of balancing the budget, which includes appropriating, making appropriations for state salaries, this bill will cost our state nothing, zero. If there's a question in your mind if you should vote for this bill, let me ask you this. As a legislator, do you ever have to worry about receiving your legislative paycheck or having it get withheld from you? The answer to that is no. So why should myself and thousands of others be subjected to dehumanizing treatment of using state employee salaries as bargaining chips? Please make this practice a thing of the past and a part of our state's history once and for all. Please vote in favor of House File 1863.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Ms. Christensen, for coming and kind of putting a personal face on this. I think that's what we often forget about in this building and what we do and how it, you know, ultimately affects people. You know, our economic positions change, and mine has personally. There was a time where living without a paycheck, I just can't imagine it. And, you know, we're in a little different position myself personally, but it's not that far back that I remember that that these things really make a difference, and it's a real fear. You know, we value our team. I know we do. Our staffers, as a member, I always like to listen to retirement speeches, and often when you listen to the retirement speeches, one of the first things people start with across party lines is thanking staff, and I am dependent upon the staff here and this building and throughout government, and I you know, we hire them in good faith to do good work. And I don't know that, in my mind, that they should be held pawns, you know, as we negotiate our deal. And, you know, I look around the table, and I get attached to actually both sides of the aisle, staff and nonpartisan staff. And, you know, I had people in my office from MnDOT yesterday, and, you know, I've known these people, and they know my sector of, you know, as a legislator, and they're working on projects, and, you know, the just on and on. You could just, I could talk about this for quite a while. I know you have a busy agenda. But ultimately, the goal is to treat people how you would want to be treated. And people are going to continue to be paid and not have that fear and deep concern in their life as we continue to negotiate the deal, if you will. So thank you for your time this morning, Mr. Chair and members, and happily stand for questions. And thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? If not, I go questions. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more a comment than a statement. In door knocking these past few years, we have quite a few state employees who live in my district. And they stated that this was an incredible hardship for them. Everybody depends on their cash flow and the uncertainty of whether or not they would have a paycheck, and not knowing how long that paycheck would be withheld was of genuine concern. So I'm just making a statement in public that I support this initiative and this bill, and I think that we need to honor our employees with the promises that we made. Your salary is your salary, and our responsibility is our responsibility to balance the budget. So thank you.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And after 2011, there was quite a bit of discussion about lights on bills, and I in previous committees where this bill has been heard, it's been brought up the issues of the variability of what the executive branch decides is essential and non-essential. In 2011, I was shocked that food banks were not considered essential. And I also noticed that when there were shutdowns for the Plenty administration and transportation specifically, they said if a project's underway, we're not going to shut it down because, you know, basically it costs you to shut it down, it costs you to start it up. It's in progress. Did you ever give, and then in 11, they just basically, it almost seemed as if it was to make it as hard and harsh as possible and shut down as much as possible. Did you ever give consideration to try and make this a more global bill? Because, there are a lot of contracted activities. Yep. There are a lot of ongoing things that, you know, like the food bank, people would consider essential. And I think it would be nice to have the bill be, I guess, more of a complete look and define some of those gray areas that would allow the executive branch to pick and choose what was affected.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you. Representative Kwan, thank you, Mr. Chair. The lights on essentially bill, or even modifying to giving executive branch some power to take a deeper look at this certainly is an ongoing discussion. I think my intent here is I totally hear what you're saying, and I realize that what happened last time essentially didn't, I think my understanding is everything was, people were kind of, didn't feel the pressure until the beer started shutting down, I think was kind of the testing of the, I think, which was a little sad to me, but, some of the testing and some of the ability on for the movement of our beer, I think, was finally what busted it loose, sadly. But I think your comments on the startup and start or of transportation projects is real. On our last committee and Chair Freiberg's committee, we heard testimony from a MnDOT employee saying exactly that. There's serious costs that are related to starting up a project again after it shuts down because of the shutdown. So your comments are 100% valid. I hear your thoughts. My goal is to essentially a little more focused and narrow. If we're unable to finish our work, it's essentially to treat people and to pay them, and then the ones that are deemed essential, essentially, I would argue that everybody's essentially, you hire everyone in good faith, and that they shouldn't be impacted. But I'm mostly focused on the payment end of it and making sure that they're financially secure and ongoing. But I've heard what you've said.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had hoped that in the committee processes that there would be, you know, some amendments to, you know, beef up and improve this bill. I think I definitely will look at now having something maybe for the floor to make it more comprehensive. And I understand and recall the comments about the alcohol or beer distribution licenses as being a motivator. I feel that people are better than how they're portrayed in the media. And I remember hours before the governor decision to accept a proposal that had been made, there was a town hall meeting in Rochester, and he invited me to sit next to him. And during the discussion, I had one question I asked: why aren't food shelves essential? And hours later, I would hope that the governor made the decision in regards to food shelves and other things instead of beer. So, you know, I hope that we can make this a more comprehensive piece of legislation. Thank you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Lilly, kind of along that same lines, how would the bill, you know, I wasn't here for that event, of course, but I've watched it in the news, and I'm curious, how would it affect things like closing parks, shutting off the beer tap, whatever it is, because not only was the event going on politically, but you have some political motivation sometimes with come into which things are to keep going and which aren't. And what I'm not reading in the bill is that there's anything to actually keep the lights on. So therefore, yes, the employees would get paid, and I can understand that. But they'd be basically paid to stay home unless something was deemed necessary enough that the overhead was being provided so that the services could be provided. So I'm looking at this as we've got half of it right, but what's going to happen with the other half?
Representative Lilly, and I see you've been joined by somebody else. Maybe that's a foreign friend to help you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Vogel, and you're absolutely correct. And you know, it's always the debate of keeping pressure on us as politicians. I mean, ideally, this would never happen again. And I do have with me some other another testifier, if that's okay. To
please identify yourself for the tape and.
Mr. Chair, members, Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director for MAPE. Thank you, and Representative Vogel, and maybe a little bit to Representative Quam's point. The Lights On bill that's been offered the last couple of bienniums really is a continuation of government as it is, which doesn't require all parties to come to the table to reach an agreement. This bill is different, and to avoid the lights-on bill. We're dealing with the employees and the hardship. So during the 2011 shutdown, employees who are deemed non-essential are not working and not getting paid. None of these employees have ever taken a job with a position description or an offer from the state government that has said, you know, we're going to offer you 2,080 hours a year in full-time employment, except for the times that the legislature and the governor can't reach a budget agreement, and then for those times you won't get any work and won't get paid. And so we were trying to hold those employees harmless here with this bill. So I think to your point, as Representative Quam said, there is an amendment you could offer, but that's a totally different piece of legislation that really is desirable by certain parties that are generally in the minority. And I'm not picking on you guys, because the Republicans, because you're in the minority. It could be the DFL when they were in the minority. The Lights On bill is really a bill that doesn't require everybody to come to the table to get an agreement. And we want there to be an agreement that's worked out by all parties and acceptable. So this is different. This is essentially what the federal government has done by offering to make these employees whole during a shutdown.
Senator Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the explanation, mm-hmm. but I'm also looking at this from the taxpayers' perspective, and there's a lot of people that I've known that have been laid off and unexpectedly and missed their paycheck,
sure.
maybe forever. And there always has been a little more job security in a public sector job than a private sector job, because these things do happen occasionally, but generally it's going to be there. It's not going to go broke like a private employer could. So I'm not diminishing the effect that it has on public employees, but I also have to look at it from a whole statewide perspective and saying, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are going to be paying taxes for people that aren't able to perform a task, basically being paid to stay home. And that's why I'm saying the bill, from my perspective, is only half done, because it's still going to be used as a, it could be used as a political tool.
Mm-hmm.
I could still see the parks being shut down and the beer tap being turned off to try to make things happen. Now, I'm not against the employees being paid, but by the same token, we're not taking the political implications out of this, because they still exist. We're paying people to stay home, basically, and we might be prolonging the agony from the standpoint that the political actions might not work. So what I'm saying is, what can we do with the bill that would get at that, so that it's fair to the state employees, but it's also fair to the state taxpayers who are paying people? And that's my point with the bill. And what can we do there? Because I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. I just think there's something missing.
Representative Lilly or Mr. Kojewski?
Mr. Chair, just a few points to Representative Vogel. Not all the employees are staying home and getting paid. Some employees who are deemed essential are working. I think the difference here, and the difference between what Representative Quam is talking about, is it's not up to the governor to just take a sheet of paper and check off who's essential this time around and who's not. The courts are involved in this process, and there's a special master appointed. And I think we to this day, there's still some questions that are out there after the governor line item vetoed the funding for the legislature as to how the shutdown is actually supposed to work. But and to your point as well, Representative Vogel, the agency funding in 2005 and 2011 was fully funded. So agencies received their full funding requests, and yet employees didn't get paid for that period of time. There was no rider language that said agencies have to do X, Y, or Z with that funding. They were given that funding, and employees were not paid. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what sticks in the craw of those employees.
And members, we have a full agenda, so let's keep our answers and our questions a little more concise. Would be great. Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you. Just one quick one then. How does a bill deal with the legislator pay? It was brought up. Is there anything that addresses whether legislators get paid in this or not?
Representative Lowe.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, it actually does it. That's one of the ironies is that we're paid. We're essential. And I was through that, and I hadn't signed up for my pay to not get it, because that's always a debate. Should I be paid when there's a shutdown or not? I personally felt I shouldn't, and I kind of missed the window. So then I got, so Hauser does his little printing list of who got paid during the shutdown, I'll be one of those people. But I ended up, I signed it over to my church. That was my, I thought about the food shelf. But I ended up going to my church. And so, but anyways, we are paid. And there's many people that, you know, and not only paid, and our health care and all that stuff is covered. And so, you know, we don't live in that fear. And that's kind of what this is essentially on that, you know, that. And there were members, there was a member that I served with that, or at the time that this person had lost their check. So we have a government shutdown, and this person, like, begged staff to somehow hand write a check, which I thought was amazing, during a shutdown, and somehow got a check. So anyways, there are members that are that do struggle, and no, but we are paid, but I think, like our staff other government employees shouldn't have to live in that fear. So I hear what you're saying, and I, you know, it may not be, you know, exactly what you want, but it's, I personally feel it's the right step in the right direction.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, so in the context of the question that Representative Vogel asked you about pay for legislators, how would any effect of the constitutional amendment that was passed a couple of years ago affect pay for legislators?
Representative Lilly, I know this bill doesn't touch on that, but Representative Lilly, if you can be short with your answer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I'm actually not sure. You mean where we sent it to an outside body to decide our pay? I'm sure maybe they could decide to not have us paid or something during a shutdown, because essentially it is outside of our purview to some degree. I don't know. I guess I don't know the answer. It's a very good question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for clarification, the phone-a-friend witness stated that it's not up to the governor, implied that the governor didn't have the flexibility. And frankly, history has indicated that each executive during a shutdown has exercised that flexibility of choosing what is essential and not, because we already have multiple times touched on that Pawlenty decided that an ongoing transportation project was not going to be shut down, and another governor in 2011 decided, you know, differently. Now, the courts do get involved, as courts always are optional to get involved about just about anything, but there's a delay, there's a process, and once something's been shut down, it's been shut down, and some of it, you've already incurred the waste. So to imply that the governor or executive branch doesn't have the flexibility to define with their authority what's essential and not is not a factual representation to present before the committee.
And that was more of a statement than a question. So Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I like about this bill is it presents this obstacle for having a shutdown. This is going to cause the legislature and the governor to think twice about going towards a shutdown. This is the kind of pause in that negotiation to get a budget approved. Mm-hmm. So this has a lot of merit in terms of the considerations that will need to take place. As we heard from previous testimony, shutting down and starting back up again doesn't just happen overnight. This causes people to pause, think about the implications in terms of what they're doing, step outside their sphere of influence, and look at the big picture with this. So this is a worthy endeavor. This is something I support.
Representative Lilly, if you can wrap up now, and yep. Short wrap up. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this. And I've spent enough time with most of you here that I know you value our employees, and I know that But it's to treat our employees essentially how you'd be treated. Yes, it may not be perfect in some areas, starting up and restarting different like projects and different things is complicated for me and just seems really highly inefficient. But I think this is a good step, and you know, hopefully it's not ever needed. It's a bit of a Band-Aid on a problem that I hope we never see. Well, so thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
And with that, I'll renew my motion to lay this over for possible inclusion. And Ms. Christensen, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next bill on the calendar is House File 136. Yeah. And members, the part that we have administration over is the Department of Administration, the AG's office and Minute. So if we can restrict our testimony and questions to that, this is going to go to jobs and commerce. The funding that, if you look in your fiscal note, the funding hits out of the Commerce Department, not of our department, but we have administration over the Department of Admin, AG's office and Minute. So hopefully we can keep our testimony to that. Representative Stevenson, and I'll move that House File 136 be re-referred to Ways and Means with the suggestion that it go to jobs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for having this hearing today. We are in sort of an unusual situation in that we have a fiscal note which says that the agencies that this committee has jurisdiction over have no cost caused by this bill, but I'm very grateful that you kept this hearing on the calendar because I know there's a lot of interest and there are people who had come to speak today, and I'm glad you're giving them the opportunity. It's hard for me to think of a more significant consumer protection issue here in Minnesota today than the need for net neutrality, given the amazing power of the internet and how it's come to impact literally every corner of our lives. It is absolutely essential that every Minnesotan have access to a fair and open internet. Today, internet service providers have the power to decide, free from any limitation, what we see when we open our browsers. Never before in our state's history has any private company had such incredible power to shape the public's understanding of the world around them. Without net neutrality, internet service providers have the unchecked power to pick winners and losers in our economy, in our culture, and in our very democracy. They can speed up your access to websites that feature products they favor. They can block access or simply slow down to the point that effectively blocks access to services they dislike. Huge established market players like Facebook can enter into agreements with internet service providers that ensure that their websites reach consumers at the highest speeds available, while startups and small businesses lacking the market money and market power to negotiate are left in the slow lane. Internet service providers will tell you that they have no interest in doing any of this. Indeed, many say that they support net neutrality, but just want one standard across the entire country. But these same companies have invested huge amounts of resources in fighting net neutrality in the Congress, at the Federal Communications Commission, and in every state capital where it's been considered. Members' actions speak louder than words, and the huge investments that these companies have made in fighting net neutrality at every turn speak for themselves. The bill before you contains two provisions. First, it enacts net neutrality into our state statute and makes it illegal for internet service providers to engage in anti-competitive, anti-free market, and anti-consumer behavior. The second provision prohibits the state from doing business with any internet service provider that does not agree to act in accordance with net neutrality principles. The idea that huge internet service providers can make decisions behind closed doors and without limitation about what information the American people have access to is frightening. All Minnesotans deserve to be able to access the internet on their own terms, not those dictated by private corporations. And before I turn it over to Mr. Gordon, I would just add one thing, is that there is an amendment that we're not taking action on today, but I wanted to briefly mention. We had some discussion in prior committees about the effect that this program had on the rural broadband grant program in the state. And in the last committee was stated we didn't think it would have much of effect because there's an exception in the bill that doesn't apply in certain circumstances that basically covered all of the broadband grant program. But just to be absolutely certain, we will be adding an amendment to this that exempts the broadband grant program in its entirety. I understand that we're going to do that, though, in the Jobs Committee, not here, because for those jurisdictional reasons.
And welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Gordon. I'm the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. Let me offer everyone's four favorite words. I will be brief. Thank you for the invitation to address your committee this morning. I appreciate the opportunity to support House File 136 and urge that Minnesota join the two dozen other states that are already working to protect net neutrality in the face of federal inaction and gridlock on this issue, which affects the way that all of us relate to each other and the way that our democracy works. Information and communication are the lifeblood of democracy, and we need to protect their flow. The Federal Communication Commission decided in December 2017 to grant Internet Service Providers, or ISPs, the ability to decide who gets on the high-occupancy vehicle lane of Internet communications and who gets relegated to the slow lane. That's not right. Arguments by the FCC and some Internet Service Providers that the end of net neutrality would foster greater freedom and innovation simply have not been proven to be true. The only thing that eliminating net neutrality did was to allow ISPs to engage in content-based discrimination, and that content-based discrimination is something that we are very opposed to and terrified by at the ACLU. This is not hypothetical. This is not something that might happen. This has happened. In 2012, AT&T blocked FaceTime from all but its premier data plans. In 2012, Comcast interfered with other streaming services. Verizon blocked text messages from pro-choice advocacy group NARAL because Verizon deemed them to be, quote, controversial, unquote. And there are many other examples. An overwhelming majority of American people believe in net neutrality and believe that the FCC's elimination of it was unacceptable. Net neutrality is the subject of legislation in four states already: Washington, Vermont, Oregon, and California. And governors of five other states have issued executive orders to try to preserve net neutrality. 83% of Americans favor preserving net neutrality. And that's why it is so important. Let me conclude by quickly dispensing with three fallacious arguments that the Internet service providers have been making in state legislatures in a coordinated effort that they've been engaged in throughout this country. One, they claim that net neutrality legislation, such as Representative Stevenson's bill, is unnecessary because they support the idea of net neutrality. Nobody spends millions of dollars to oppose an idea that they're really in favor of. Two, the ISPs claim that it would be impossible to abide by different rules in different states. Number one, it's not true. It's been proven to be false in many other areas, including consumer protection, including automobile vehicle standards. But the more important thing, I think the more salient thing, is this. The industry has brought this on itself by eliminating federal standards for net neutrality. We would support federal standards for net neutrality. They've prevented it from happening. So here we are in the states fighting about it state by state. They're killing off net neutrality rules on a federal level and then come crying to the states about why the states shouldn't be doing anything. It's a little bit like the guy who kills both of his parents and then seeks mercy on the grounds that he's an orphan. I don't think that we should be fooled by that kind of argument. The last argument is that the FTC is going to take care of it. The FTC is not going to take care of it. That's been demonstrated. This country has always enforced neutrality in the services that bind us together as a nation. First it was canals, then railroads, then highways, then telegraph wires, then telephone systems. Today, it's the Internet. If anyone is going to pick up the banner of net neutrality and move it forward in 2019, it is going to be the states, not the federal government. I urge the members of this committee to vote for House File 136. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a list of testifiers here, and a couple have pulled their names off. The next one I have is Anna Boroff. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna Boroff, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. And in light of the fiscal note and in our conversations with the chair, and out of respect for that, I'm going to limit my testimony to the portions of the bill that are under the jurisdiction of the committee, which is everything except for the commerce portion, from my understanding, so I will do that. Minnesota cable companies serve customers in every area of the state. They are large, mid-sized, and small. They serve over 1.4 million customers across Minnesota, and I do want to be clear, all Minnesota cable companies support and strictly adhere to the principles of net neutrality. The principles include no blocking of legal content, no throttling of traffic, no unfair discrimination, and transparent consumer practices. These are binding and enforceable by the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission.
Closer?
Yeah. Better? Yes. Data travels without regard for state lines. Several of our members cross multiple state borders. What is deemed as reasonable risk management in one state could be entirely different in another. This is why a unified national approach is the best path to ensure consistent net neutrality principles. So Minnesota cable companies have a variety of ways in which we do business with the state. With this bill, member companies would be significantly concerned about doing business with state and local governments. If this ambiguously worded bill were to become law and we were accused of violating it, we would be faced with significant financial penalties. A minor infraction or an erroneous decision by a state agency ill-equipped to understand or investigate reasonable network management practices could be devastating. And for example, for a state or local contract, the bill contains a clawback provision if an ISP is found to be violating a net neutrality principle. Would all revenues earned under the contract mean the amount of the contract, or would it mean all revenue earned from our customers as a result of the contract would be clawed back? Under this bill, every ISP contract with a state agency or political subdivision would contain a provision requiring the state agency to unilaterally terminate the ISP contract and refund to the agency all revenue earned under the contract if they determined that a net neutrality violation had occurred. If an ISP had a contract to provide services to Minute or the Department of Admin, are those agencies responsible for investigating net neutrality provisions or violations? If the ISP has a contract with a city, which all of our cable franchises are, would it be the city's responsibility to investigate net neutrality violations? Internet companies want to continue to make the case for investment in our broadband networks. By creating regulatory uncertainty, you will have a direct and adverse impact on their ability to finance improvements and extend their networks. We urge the committee to reject the state approach to net neutrality and instead focus your attention and leadership on supporting public policy that will encourage investment, competition, and innovation. Thank you for the committee's time.
Thank you. Next, I have Perry Mulcrone. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is, and members, my name is Perry Mulcrone. I'm with Scott County Local Government, the County Enterprise Officer. I've been working, managing our outside fiber plant, more than 1,000 miles of it, for the past 15 years. I'm a technologist and grew up in information technology. I'm here this morning in support of the bill and would encourage this committee to support it. Scott County has used its fiber very innovatively in the past 15 years to not only connect its institutions, but to drive economic development. We were able to attract companies like Emerson and Shutterfly and Amazon using our broadband and as an incentive. We are also trying to use our fiber to drive broadband to our very underserved and unserved areas of Scott County. So my encouragement on this bill is that I find it interesting as we're the southern half of our county, which is really struggling, a lot of them are on speeds less than a meg. When they would finally get broadband at the standards of 10 by 1 or 25 by 3, I'm fearful that they would eventually, you know, essentially feel a slowdown on the content. Some content is prioritized over other content. And never really truly realize the full open pipe of 25 by 3. So it's just the content, and the content would end up being prioritized. I think that's a dangerous thing. I thank you this morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. The next person I have on my list is Paul Wirtz. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Wirtz. I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. Let me just offer a few brief comments, and I know you have a one-pager in here about our position on open internet. Let me state that AT&T is committed to an open internet. We do not block websites. We do not censor online content. We do not throttle, discriminate, or degrade internet traffic, period. We have publicly committed to these principles for over 10 years now. We will continue to abide by them in order to provide our customers with the open internet experience they have come to expect. These commitments are published on our website. They were reiterated by our Chairman Randall Stevenson in an open letter last year. And these commitments are enforceable already by the Minnesota Attorney General, the Federal Trade Commission, and their Federal Communications Commission. I have to tell you, a few weeks ago, we were accused of censoring the rock band Pearl Jam as a reason for why we need net neutrality. Today, you know, AT&T and others are the Menendez brothers, equivalent of killing your parents. You know, this bill is really a solution looking for a problem. I'll give you another example, this FaceTime issue that was just brought up. Claims that AT&T acted anti-competitively by blocking FaceTime are inaccurate. When Apple announced in 2012 that the FaceTime app would be preloaded on phones and usable on cellular networks, AT&T, which has tens of millions of iPhone customers, was legitimately concerned that heavy use of FaceTime could cause network congestion that would impair service quality on its network and negatively impact user experience. Ultimately, this went to the FCC. They found no evidence of wrongdoing. This is why we need a national framework for this, not a state-specific, so that, you know, by signing some attestation of doing business in the state of Minnesota, whether AT&T is trying to get a small cell application or a right-of-way application, we're now forced to go to the Department of Commerce so someone there can use an interpretation of a FaceTime example or a Pearl Jam example, something like that. So just wanted to express those comments here to the committee today, Mr. Chairman. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Representative Christensen, when you go back to the table, and I have a question here from Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, in the testimony they touched on, this is about limiting access to information, touched on this is not how our democracy works and how, you know, history and other areas have been covered. And I'm curious from the author, how would this, you know, presently television and radio are prohibited from limiting, you know, campaign and other information. How will this enforce so that internet entities can't censor one side and not the other, refuse to take ads from one candidate or, you know, groups from a certain side, and how would we enforce that to national and international type entities?
Representative Christensen. Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kwong, I think it's an important point that there are certainly applications of net neutrality in our democracy and that we want to make sure that the internet service providers and other corporations aren't picking winners and losers, choosing to speed up access to candidates and causes that they support and slowing down or blocking access to candidates and causes that they disfavor. And so what net neutrality does is ensure that for anyone who's providing content on the internet, that they're playing on a level playing field, which means that there shouldn't be discrimination based on ideology or political agenda by ISPs in terms of what content they deliver to consumers.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And clarifying and focusing the question, how would this enforce, and I will give some examples, Facebook, Twitter, well, we'll just start out with those two. How will this bill prevent them from censorship or preventing limiting access to information, which censorship is the extreme example of?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwong, I feel very confident that Twitter is not an internet service provider. I feel pretty confident that Facebook is also not internet service provider, they're content providers. So I don't think that this bill has an application for those two specific entities. This bill, the neutrality requirement applies to service providers, not content providers. Having said that, I'm not trying to minimize the problem that you're discussing. This bill just doesn't have a particular application to that issue.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for clarification, this bill isn't addressing the situation on the internet that we as a state address for other information conduits such as the television, such as radio, and you know, where we guarantee not limiting access to information, and you know, we consider as being key. Why doesn't your bill, if it's trying to address the problem, actually take care of, you know, real examples of what we're doing for other conduits of information? I see it as a extreme shortcoming if we're not providing those protections that each of us are very aware of and are so key to our democracy. And, you know, as some of the testifiers stated, not how our democracy works.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, you know, I wish that my bill could be the solution to all of the consumer protection issues that we face with regard to the internet. It can't. This bill tackles a very serious problem with regard to internet service providers. There may be room for additional legislation that tackles additional problems, and I frankly would be happy to work with you on that.
Representative Quam.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions on the fiscal note.
Okay. And maybe Ms. Roberts can help answer those questions.
You better. Page 5, which I know is the Commerce Department, but it refers to Attorney General and Office of Min, the fifth paragraph down, where it starts with all with the above volume.
Yeah, I see that. It says each administrative hearing costs the Attorney General's office $3,000, and but that's not, they didn't put that in, that's in the, that wasn't put in that, our part of it. So I understand what you're saying.
I guess, Mr. Chair, it was an explanation on what it means, because I know that we're not talking about commerce, but we're talking about the Attorney General budget, we're talking about admin budget, and it appears to me that even though Commerce is going to have the five investigators, that it would involve admin and the Attorney General with some cost. And that was the question.
Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, I don't know if there's anyone here from the Attorney General's office that can clarify this, but or from Commerce, but I believe that when agency is involved in an administrative hearing process, that they are responsible for paying those costs. So even though the Attorney General would be involved, it would be Commerce that would be paying for those costs.
Well, thank you, Mr.
Representative Vogel.
Part of the fiscal note, though, I don't see anything with the Office of Administrative Hearings in the fiscal note.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, I think generally we don't assign the Office of Administrative Hearing to fiscal notes just because they may be involved at some point in an administrative hearing action, because again, the cost would be for the agency that is subject to those kind of to that process.
Representative.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And if we go to page 8, which is admin, it says that the Office of State Procurement's role is to include these agreements as part of their applicable contracts, and that they don't anticipate that there would be any fiscal impact. And, you know, we had quite a discussion a few weeks ago on the purchasing plan and not properly really enforcing the contracts that they have out on the purchasing program. And I'm wondering if there's somebody here from admin that could speak to if they're indeed going to have to put this extra condition in their contracts, why they don't feel that there would be any time needed to then enforce their contracts. I realize that part of it goes back to what we just talked about with the administrative hearings, but they also have these group purchase things that I would think it's going to affect.
I see someone coming down here. I know on the group purchase thing is the state has does the contract. They negotiate a price for the state, and they're not the ones enforcing it, but they allow other subdivisions of the state to be able to buy using that contract. But those are contracts between that subdivision and whoever they're buying from on the contract. It's not the state involved in the other than negotiating the price at the beginning. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape, and maybe we can get an answer.
Mr. Chair, my name is Julie Byrell from the Department of Administration. It's my understanding that the majority of the internet that the state uses is handled by MNET, which is our proprietary fiber network that we work with the U of M to do. And so net neutrality would not apply to that. And it would only apply to those connections outside of that MNET network, which are small for folks who are working in outstate Minnesota, perhaps from home, and those connections from their house to the consumer network.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question was, when we look at, I forget what the proper name of the group purchasing program is, cooperative purchasing, I guess, okay, if indeed admin is involved in doing contracts on that, they would be precluded, as I understand it, if these conditions with net neutrality applied. So if you're doing a group purchasing that involves internet, then you're going to have to enforce that contract. And the question was, would there not be any more cost to enforcing your contracts that you're putting out on the cooperative purchasing because it may affect internet providers?
Representative Christensen. I see you put your finger up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note for Representative Vogel that under subdivision 5 of this, if you look at lines 311 and 312, you'll see that violations under this section are to be enforced by the Department of Commerce.
Representative Vogel.
Okay, well, we're not getting exactly where it is. So now let's go to page 11, Attorney General. Mr. Chair, it refers to under assumptions there is a chance of litigation relative to net neutrality, but there is no dollar specified, even though there's ongoing court cases. I'm not sure if somebody here is from the Attorney General's office, but I'm curious. I think we just had House File 400 with a fiscal note that anticipated that there might be a cost there because there's some ongoing litigation with those issues. If indeed that's the case with that, then why, since there's already some court issues with this, wouldn't we anticipate some cost with this?
And I think we've had that discussion before, but Ms. Roberts, do we plan for anticipated lawsuits, anticipated things in our budget, or do we do those after the fact when we have had a judgment against us?
Mr. Chair, members, in this case, under the way that fiscal notes and the fiscal note policy, this is considered a secondary cost, and that's why they're not showing a dollar amount, but do include it in the assumption so that members are aware that there's a possibility of it. And then I believe that was the same issue that came up with the House File 400.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you. One more. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but
it's okay. There's
a lot of stuff in this fiscal note. Page 14 with a minute, the paragraph near the bottom where it says that they may need to consider upgrading to different providers, because I realize there's an exception that if there's only one provider that they can still use that provider, but it also talks there about it may be unlikely or impossible they may upgrade about 30% of the state's current internet-based ISP. I'm just curious, when they talk about that, there's no fiscal impact relative to minute on page 14. When we talk about upgrading 30% of something with minute, it seems like a lot of money. Curious if somebody there could just address, I know it seems like a remote possibility, but it's included in the note, what that 30% of what? Is it 30% of 5,000 or 500 or whatever?
And is there anybody here for minute? I don't see anybody here for minute.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, just a question. Maybe they could get back and further explain that, because just good to have this thing as accurate as possible. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, in your research when you were doing this bill, did you know of any utility companies that slow down power or dim power to any of their providers?
Representative Stevenson.
I'm not aware of any utility company that is able to that does that specifically, no.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, how about gas utility companies? Are they able to do that to their?
I'm not aware of any gas utility that engages in that.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Stevenson, why would that? Is there anything protecting us from having that happen?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe there are legal protections prohibiting utilities from engaging in that kind of discrimination in their delivery, yes.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, in my line of work in emergency medicine, we're finding that the Internet is becoming more of a tool of our trade, and we're seeing that in-home care is becoming more and more popular, and a lot of the devices are Bluetooth devices, very Internet-depending, and to have this happen where all of a sudden an Internet provider has this freedom to slow down and adjust, it just isn't acceptable. So I appreciate you bringing this bill for at least for my industry and for our patients out there. Thank you.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill. As Mr. Gordon pointed out, net neutrality is exceptionally popular with the public and with Minnesotans, which I think is why we find Internet service providers are unable to say that they oppose it publicly and are unable to argue against it publicly. But behind the scenes, we know that that's not been their action. The Federal Communications Commission did take action on net neutrality, which the Internet service providers fought with every fiber of their being. And I used to work in the federal government, and we worked in Congress, in fact. We considered net neutrality legislation. I can't recall an Internet service provider supporting any of the net neutrality legislation that we were working on. I also recall them in 2017. I looked this up. AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon spent $26 million to lobby against net neutrality. So on the one hand, they're saying that they want a federal solution, and on the other hand, at the federal level, they're fighting against Federal Communications Commission efforts and against congressional efforts to have any net neutrality. So I want to thank you for bringing this forward until I think the Internet service providers are willing to have a federal solution, which they haven't been so far. We need to act at the state level.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Long. And it's a good bill. I totally agree with what Representative Long said, and I ask for the committee's support.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Stevenson. I think it's been mentioned in this committee already that California implemented a very similar net neutrality law, and they are engaged in litigation with the FCC currently. Do you know how much the state of California has expended on behalf of the state fighting a federal government agency over this issue?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I am not aware of how much the state of California has expended in that litigation.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stevenson, this calls into a whole range of subject matter, and that's why we're kind of narrowing the focus here, but I hope that the chair would allow some leeway here. Why would you want to enforce and put into statute a law that you know full well will be litigated by the FCC?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I think that this is a really important law. and I think there's a couple things that are in here that probably won't be subject to litigation. In fact, what we've been spending a lot of our time talking about here, the first section of the law, likely would not be subject to litigation, and I think it's an important piece. I also think that the litigation you're referring to very well could be resolved by the time that this law goes into effect. In an earlier stop in the committee process, we move back the enactment date expressly with that in mind.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stevenson, in your just recent comments, you said that certain portions of your bill probably would not be subject to litigation. What sections of your bill do you believe would be subject to litigation?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I have no prediction about what would be. I'm saying that I don't believe that there's been any suggestion that Section 1 would be subject to litigation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Stevenson, what sections of the bill are similar or phrased in ways that are similar to the laws on the books in California?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I haven't conducted a side-by-side analysis of those two laws.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Stevenson, it seems that you've taken your cues from someone, not to go to motives here, but what under circumstances did you prepare the legislation itself?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I guess I just told you that I have not done a side-by-side comparison of the California law and the Minnesota law.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson, what is the penalty for perjury?
Representative Stevenson, I don't know. I think we're getting into motives and
yeah. You
can hear a little bit, but Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, and the reason I ask is that there's a section in the legislation that talks about perjury with a fine and I'm just curious in terms of, with regard to the penalty for perjury, who the entity would be accused of perjury.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, you're speaking from outdated information. That provision was removed in the last committee stop. There's no reference to perjury in the statute in the bill as it exists now.
Representative Albright.
So with that in mind, I just have one final question. With regard to smaller, greater Minnesota areas that, and you probably heard this in other stops, what type of an effect would this have on Greater Minnesota with broadband introduction and or maintenance?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I would make two points. One, you may have, I'm not sure if you were here in my introductory remarks where I indicated that already in the bill there's language that exempts probably the entire broadband grant program. To make sure that the entire broadband grant program is exempted, there's an amendment that is drafted that we initially intended to add on today. Given the limited jurisdiction, we're going to do it in the Jobs Committee at the next stop, but that would exempt the broadband grant program specifically and in its entirety. I think that you heard a great point from the gentleman who was here from Scott County today about how the issue of net neutrality is of particular importance in Greater Minnesota, areas that are underserved by internet service providers. Where I live, I have multiple choices about who I can go to buy my internet. If I don't like the decisions that my internet service provider is making about what content they are bringing to me and at what speeds, I can go to their competitor. If I live in a community that has only one internet service provider, I very well may not have that luxury. I think that everybody in Minnesota deserves access to an open and fair internet, and I think that it's even more important in Greater Minnesota that we have these protections because there are less options about who you can go to get your service.
Representative Albright. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And earlier it was suggested that utilities don't limit or throttle, and that's not true. The natural gas and electricity, the utilities and heat waves, cold snaps, some years ago there were brownouts, they do and have a habit of in occurrences limiting, gating, and you know, making adjustments to access to their utility. In fact, many of us in Minnesota have things on our air conditioners to where if there is a energy, you know, whatever the appropriate phrase for it, but it's a high energy utilization day, they can throttle back and limit the electricity to the air conditioning units. So I just wanted to clarify for this committee what was stated before is that there actually are occurrences. It's not a very high frequency, but it is allowed and happens. Many businesses are also affected. Schools have had to have their electricity access curtailed on these energy emergency days in schools in Minnesota. So I just wanted to clear for the record that utilities adjusting access or controlling access or throttling access are not unheard of.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up.
I'm not going to get into an argument.
No, just be brief. Basically, what I understand about that, though, Representative Quam, is that that is an option you can have, because I have that same option. So that's this is something that they can just do, and I'm concerned about that. So I just, on that note, I've done.
Chair, Mr. Chair, there are instances where it's not an option, and I can get offline, go offline, and clarify and educate.
Representative Stevenson, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 136 be re-referred to Ways and Means, and I've got a note here that some discussion of where it's going to go, so I'll let the chair of Ways and Means, the Uber chair, to be able to make that decision. So all in favor of re-referring House File 136 to Ways and Means, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, sir. Representative 1644, or House File 1644. And members, we got 15 minutes left, and we've got three more bills, including this one, so if we can move this along and
so Representative Chair, I'd like to move House File 1644.
For possible inclusion.
Yes, please.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, put simply, the stakes for Minnesota couldn't be any higher in the next census. We literally kept the last seat up for grabs in 2010, the 435th seat. We only did this because we had a strong census with the second highest response rate in the country. Right now, we are ranked 437th for our 8th congressional seat, meaning that two states are ahead of us. Montana right now is 436th. And California is 435th. The margin for whether we keep that 8th seat could be as few as 10,000 people. I don't think I have to explain all of the stakes to members, but just to remind them, that would mean we'd lose a congressional seat in Congress, we'd lose an Electoral College vote, we would lose the influence that comes from having our full delegation in Congress right now representing us on our behalf. We also are at risk of losing over $15 billion in federal money that is allocated to Minnesota based on the census, which goes to everything from Medicare to school lunches to highway construction. Every uncounted Minnesotan would cost the state approximately $15,000 before the next census. And for perspective, there was a study done on Wisconsin for the 2010 census. A 1% undercount in their 2010 census would have cost them $76 million in Medicaid funding. So there are real dollars at stake for our state. This bill targets communities that are historically under-respond, and that's a broad range of groups, including rural residents, renters, low-wealth communities, highly mobile residents, kids, and college students. The bill would help support the work of the state demographer during this critical time and establish a grant program to increase awareness about the census, engage historically under-counted communities, and to help recruit census workers. It would also assist census workers in gaining access to apartment buildings. So in closing, members, we have a real opportunity here. The federal census has had a number of challenges in terms of underfunding and leadership change. We have a chance in Minnesota to do this right once again, as we did in 2010, and make sure that we are keeping federal dollars in our state and maintaining our 8th congressional seat. This is a bipartisan bill with 7 Republican co-authors. It has support from the governor in his budget and support from across the state. And with that, I'd like to introduce my testifier, Bob Tracy, with the Minnesota Census Mobilization Partnership.
Please state your name for the tape, and if you can go quickly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tracy. I'm Director of Public Policy and Communication for the Minnesota Council on Foundations. I'm here today representing the Council on Foundations, which is a membership group of corporate giving programs, community foundations, and private foundations throughout the state, but also on behalf of the Minnesota Census Mobilization Partnership. The partnership is a network of community groups, business groups, regional development associations, and others who are committed to working both with the Census Bureau and the State Demographer's Office to ensure that we have a fully inclusive and accurate count in 2020. We support the appropriation request that's in front of the committee today. We want you to know that it reflects the outcome of strategic conversations that involve those involved with the partnership and also with the State Demographic Center and the Census Bureau. Similar initiatives are also in the governor's budget. The proposals for appropriation address some of the unique challenges presented by this census, and they include activities that we believe can best or most uniquely be addressed at the state level. You have in your packets a summary of the provisions in the bill. I'm happy to address those provisions and questions. I do want to draw your attention to one part of the bill, Section 2, Subdivision 1C, which addresses the disbursement of these funds, including a waiver provision possibly for the Department of Administration. We will be coming forward with new language as this bill sits in this committee and waits for final inclusion and preparation for your omnibus bill. But what you can expect is that the language that we would be proposing to replace the current Section 2, Subdivision 1C, is addressed on page 3 of the fiscal note, where it identifies issues that members of the partnership, others in the community, in conversation with the Department of Administration and staff, identified as important to managing the disbursement of these funds. Again, I'm happy to address any questions you might have about the rationale for bringing this proposal before the committee, and also Susan Brower, Minnesota State Demographer, is here and available to address any technical questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question might be for you or for Representative Long. This is being laid over?
This is being laid over for possible inclusion. It will be in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long, on in Section 3 under the appropriation, I still note, and I understand that the fiscal note just came to us yesterday, so I appreciate that. But I'm just wondering, you know, for the sake of certainty, what amount does that dotted line look like to you in terms of are you going to fulfill it with the amount cited in the fiscal note, or is there some amount that you had in mind that's different from this fiscal note?
Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, yes, the $2.5 million is the request based on the assessed need here as outlined in the fiscal note.
And Representative Albright, I think the governor's budget had it at 1.6. So,
okay.
In previous discussions I've had, it's what the request is scalable at. What they get will be depend on how much they can do.
And Mr. Chair, just to that point, we certainly appreciate the governor putting the amount he did in his budget. I think that this is a small price to pay to make sure that we're maintaining the millions of dollars that come in from the federal government, and this is our best estimate of what the need would be to do this program effectively.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it's early, and I haven't had my second quarter coffee yet. Could you just reiterate what you said about the scalability on the federal? I didn't follow that. I'm sorry.
I think in my talks with Mr. Tracy in the past, I asked him when they're asking for the 2.5, whether if they get less, they can scale it, you know, scale it down or up. If they get more, they can probably do more. That's what I mean, the scalability. Right. And Representative, Mr. Long is shaking his head, or Mr. Tracy's shaking his head.
So, Mr. Chair, and again, maybe this is a question for you, actually for Ms. Roberts, or for Representative Long, whoever wants to take a stab at it. So the governor in his budget put in $1.6 million. I'm curious just why there's a differentiation between the amount and the fiscal note. My assumption is that the governor didn't have the fiscal note in front of him, and so it's a presumption on his part that that's what it might cost, and now we have a more certain figure. I just want to understand why that there's a disparity between the two.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and members, I note the first sentence under assumptions that when the administration was preparing this fiscal note, they used the $2.5 million figure based on the materials that were submitted in support of the bill. So because often when you have a bill that has a blank appropriation, an agency won't know, you know, it's dependent on the legislature's decision on how to allocate funds. But because they had this proposal, that's their starting point.
One final question then, Mr. Chair, and this might be for the testifier, but on page 3, and I'm not sure we're putting this in the statute, or would be, between 3.16 and 3.19. It just talks about job sourcing initiatives and encourage a sufficient pool of qualified candidates to apply for positions with the Census Bureau. I'm just wondering what that relates to, and is there a federal match on that? What does that mean?
Mr. Tracy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, the Census Bureau hires the census staff. It's estimated they're going to need to hire approximately 7,500 people in Minnesota. In this market, and for other reasons, we know that they are having great difficulty even creating an applicant pool for those jobs. So what we are looking at doing is working with community-based organizations to really help get the word out about the availability of these positions and to create a big enough applicant pool so that the Census Bureau can actually hire people who are from and reflective of the communities where they're going to have to do that more targeted enumeration activity. The Census Bureau is having trouble hiring, and we just want to make sure that Minnesotans get those jobs and the right Minnesotans are hired to reach the historically undercounted communities.
Just quickly then to the testifier on 3.20 to follow on to your answer then, when it talks about initiatives to engage historically undercounted communities, nebulous words, not gotcha question, but I want to understand, what are we going after?
Mr. Long. Mr. Tracy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. Representative Long identified in his testimony what are some of the historically undercounted communities in the census in Minnesota. You may also hear that same cluster of populations referred to as hard to count. But the communities that we've worked with have chosen to refer to them as historically undercounted. But it is that group of communities that Representative Long cited.
And to the question on initiatives, there are a number of complete count committees that have been created around the state. This would help support their efforts to engage the local communities, particularly undercounted communities, in getting the word out about the census and making sure that there's high visibility and awareness about the census.
Representative Long. Any other questions, ma'am? If not, I'll renew my motion that this be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The next bill we've got, and if this will be our last bill today, Representative Hewitt's bill is going to be moved over till Tuesday. Representative Cantrell. And while he's cleaning up here, Representative Vogel, do you get a chance to look at the minutes?
I was waiting to move him, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vogel moves the minutes for the approval of the minutes for March 20th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
Mason.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm looking at this under
House File 6098. I'm not seeing Joel Glazer's name as a testifier.
We'll lay this over for our next meeting and get it corrected. Thank you for pointing that out. Well, with that, Representative Cantrell, I move House File 2053 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Describe your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to join you this morning. I'm proud to present to you today House File 2053, a bill that will incorporate the Office of Enterprise Sustainability into Statute 16B, which is the Department of Administration statute. This office was established by Executive Order 1712 about 2 years ago in order to assist all state agencies with sustainability objectives in the pursuit of the ultimate goal of reducing the output of greenhouse gas emissions produced by the state of Minnesota, or state government of Minnesota. The goal of this office is achieved through helping to develop plans to meet statutory sustainability requirements, tracking results at the agency and state level to ensure accountability of state government and agencies toward achieving sustainability targets in a cost-effective and cost-reducing manner, and finding subject matter experts to ensure that all necessary components of sustainability plans are thoroughly vetted to achieve optimal success. The office currently consists of 3 staff members who are engaged in 38 projects in the pursuit of greater sustainability for our state government. Incorporating this office into the Department of Administration will further certify the credibility and stature of the work being conducted by the Office of Enterprise Sustainability. At this time, Mr. Chair, I'll turn the presentation over to Aaron Campbell to further explain the office and answer any questions on this bill. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Erin Campbell. I'm one of the assistant commissioners at the Department of Administration. The Office of Enterprise Sustainability, or OES, was created to provide leadership, consistency, and accountability to all state government agencies in meeting their sustainability goals. It was modeled after similar offices in the private sector. OES supports all state agencies in meeting defined sustainability goals with a focus on saving money and implementing socially and environmentally responsible solutions. Staff also create and share best practices and tools and offer assistance to local governments when requested. The services provided by OES help improve government efficiency, avoid some of the long-term costs of operating state government, and improve accountability and transparency in government operations. And importantly, it allows a state to lead by example. While OES was modeled after best practices in the private sector, the very notion of this type of office in state government is unique. Additionally, the office has created first-of-their-kind products such as master contracts for solar installations and negotiated rate packages with Xcel Energy for renewables on the Capitol complex. This office sets the state of Minnesota up to be a national leader in sustainable operations. In order to give credibility and long-term authority to the work of the office, we're asking that OES be codified in the Department of Administration statutes. It makes sense to do so in order to ensure the work continues regardless of administration. Thank you.
Any further anybody in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? If not, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. What we're doing here apparently is changing something from an executive order to a statutory entity, and I'm wondering what the rationale behind that is.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vogel. The rationale behind incorporating the Office of Enterprise Sustainability into the Department of Administration statutes, rather than just allowing it to remain executive order, is to really give stature and credibility to the work that the Office of Enterprise Sustainability is doing. Through the measures that are through the energy efficiency measures proposed and the guidance offered by this office, it really is not only helping our state to run more energy efficiently, but it's also helping our state agencies to save quite a bit of costs as well. So I think giving credibility to that work by codifying it into statute is important.
Representative. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Crintel. Okay, so, you know, the fiscal note, and I can understand there's kind of a, maybe there might be at this point a neutral impact on what's happening now, but would there be any change relative to base budget now that it's going to become a statutory entity versus just a, an executive order within a department?
Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, members, as you can see on the fiscal note, the office is currently funded through interagency agreements with cabinet agencies, and this does not change that arrangement, so presumably the funding would continue at the same level.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. So just follow up. So basically, even though we're turning it into a statutory entity, it won't show up as part of the base budget for a separate entity now versus just being included in the entire mass of the department?
Ms. Roberts.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I would be tracking it as a special revenue fund expenditure for the department. This bill doesn't create any kind of new appropriation or new general fund appropriation for the office. So that's how we would show it.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify that. I know, you know, right now it's in the department, and I didn't know if we'd be adding possibly to the expenditures. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Albright. I shouldn't have looked at you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cantrell, what is preventing the Department of Administration from formalizing and incorporating the Office of Enterprise Sustainability within their operations currently?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. I wonder if my testifier might have an answer for that question.
Ms. Campbell.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright. This does exist at the Department of Administration. It's really a matter of whether it appears in statute or not. So the work occurs on a day-to-day basis at the Department of Administration and within the entire enterprise.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I think you answered my question why there's no need for codifying it if the work is already being done and already being enforced by the Department of Administration. Because something is good doesn't mean it needs a title and an office and a budget. If another group can already do the work, which you just said is being accomplished within the Department of Administration. Representative Cantrell, or to the testifier, we have these interagency funding agreements. How much funding is being realized by this office already through these interagency agreements?
Ms. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the interagency agreements are for $450,000 in the last fiscal year.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so by my way of reckoning, you've already got a budget, Representative Cantrell, that's already more than taking care of the efforts of this. If the work is being done, it's being supported by the Department of Administration. I see wholly no reason why this should be put into codification. That just kills more trees. I know Representative Eklund would like that, but but I see no reason to discontinue the current role that this office plays. To your point about regardless of what administration is in control of the executive branch, if you're doing good work, both sides will recognize it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2053 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you.
And with that, members, House File 893, we're going to move that to Tuesday's agenda. And with that, members, we're adjourned.